Hello, I'm Aaron Lohr, and this is the Endocrine News Podcast. We have a special episode today where we'll be discussing a complex, rare disease called fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva, or FOP. It's a special episode because we have three guests, and if you're the sort of person who's interested in accreditation, this episode is accredited for 0.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits and 0.5 ABIM MOC points. If you want those credits and points, you're going to need to go to the Endocrine Society Center for Learning and take a short pre-test, then listen to this episode there, and then take a short post-test. We'll include a link to the Society Center for Learning in today's episode description. Make sure you follow that order, though, or you may find yourself listening to this episode more than once, which isn't a bad thing, really, because it's going to be fantastic. Now, before I introduce our guests, let me first say that this episode is supported by an educational grant from Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals Incorporated. Thank you. Now, let's meet our guests. First, we have Dr. Eileen Shore, the Kelly and Weldon Professor in FOP at Penn Medicine. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We also have Dr. Elizabeth Merlise Ekoff, endocrinologist, principal investigator, and medical specialist at Amsterdam University Medical Center. Thank you for being here.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the kind introduction.
We also have Michelle Davis, Executive Director of the International Fibrodysplasia Ossificans Progressiva Association. And thank you as well for being here.
Hello. Thank you for including me today. And I'm very excited for your audience to learn more about FOP.
I'm also excited about it. So let's get into it. What is fibrodysplasia ossificans progressiva, which I'm going to be calling FOP from now on?
FOP is a very rare genetic disorder of heterotopic ossification or extraskeletal bone formation. The extra bone typically begins to form in soft connective tissues such as skeletal muscle during early childhood and episodically progresses during a person's lifetime. It's important to keep in mind that the ectopic bone is not just a mass of misdifferentiated bone cells. It actually forms through a process that organizes cells to form new bone tissue. And as bone formation is occurring, the integrity and the identity of the tissue where the bone forms is lost.
We mentioned earlier that FOP is a rare disorder. How rare is it?
FOP is sometimes described as an ultra-rare condition. The estimated prevalence is about 1 in 1 million people, with about less than 1,000 confirmed cases worldwide. Rare genetic diseases are caused by mutations in genes of such critical importance that changes in the expression or functions of these genes are rarely tolerated. And they provide the opportunity for some unique insight. The gene that is mutated in FOP is called ACVR1. And to date, everyone clinically diagnosed with FOP has been found to have a mutation in ACVR1. Strikingly, most people, about 90 to 95% estimated with FOP, share the exact same specific mutation, a single nucleotide substitution that causes the replacement of a single amino acid in the resulting protein.
Are there any challenges in making a diagnosis, and does age matter when it comes to diagnosis?
Well, FOP can't be diagnosed by confirming the genetic testing, where you can demonstrate a mutation in the ACVR1 gene. But of course, when a patient is at birth, you can already see the first sign to an abnormal positioned short big toe, which often presents as a hallux valgus. If you can't confirm the diagnosis by blood testing, then the diagnosis can be made by the finding of the abnormal big toe together with progressive heterotopic ossifications of muscles, tendons, and ligaments. However, those heterotopic ossifications only start after the 4th or 5th years of age. So it can be challenging if no one recognized the abnormal big toe. And does it matter when it comes to diagnosis? Yes. The earlier the diagnosis is made, the better you can take preventive measures. For example, avoid intramuscular injections, two operations, or treatment of trauma.
I think it's also interesting to share that while most children are born with the funny shaped toes, there are really sort of two paths or two ages of diagnosis that we see. The first is for children that are in infancy or toddler stage. Oftentimes, you know, they're born, they have the funny shaped toes. Most doctors will tell the parents that it's cosmetic, but parents do oftentimes end up Googling, you know, funny toes or bent toes. And they may not get too much from that. Sometimes they're told they're bunions, but then they'll maybe start noticing that their child isn't hitting some of the milestones, like they don't turn their head, or they might scoot on their bottom instead of crawling. And what we know later is that because much of the neck has already started to have some deformity in the way those joints were developed, the children can't turn their head and they can't look up to see where they're going when they're crawling, so they scoot on their bottom. So they'll see maybe those couple of things, but it's still not like adding up yet. And then they'll start to see these swellings that will come up and disappear. They usually start the swellings on the head, neck, shoulders, and back. It could occur in the same space or a different space. And this is usually what sparks a visit with the physician. That is when people go to a doctor. And oftentimes what we know now is that it is misdiagnosed almost 50% of the time as cancer when they see those swellings. So it takes an average time of about 1.5 years for a proper diagnosis, which sounds like it's a very, very long time, and it is, but it's actually a much shorter diagnosis window than it used to take. It used to take 5 to 10 years to get a diagnosis. In these children, when they're toddlers, you know, many of them, the disease will start once they get those swellings, the disease is starting to advance. And so they'll grow up with those limitations. So as the disease advances, they might lose the use of their shoulders or their elbows earlier in life. But what we see in those children is that they really do kind of grow with their limitations and adapt well. The other path that we see is patients that are diagnosed as teens. They probably have the funny shaped toes. The parents have been told it's cosmetic, but the children still do some of the things, the scooting instead of crawling, but there's really nothing else noticeable. These kids oftentimes play sports or they're involved in other physical activities, but for some reason, they don't experience those swellings or those flare-ups and loss of mobility until they're in their teenage years. We think that it could be a result of an injury, a more significant injury like a sports injury, but it could also, we believe, be part of the onset that comes with puberty. And so for these children, their life is very different. They have grown up now. Most of them are teenagers, and they've lived a very normal life playing sports and activities. And now they're being told, you have to give up these activities. You must be much more cautious and careful. That can mean changes in, you know, activities and friend groups. And so for these children, the emotional toll of a later diagnosis is oftentimes more difficult.
Are there any preventive measures worth considering regarding FOP?
Yeah, for sure. There are various preventive measures possible. First of all, to avoid any trauma. And then you have to avoid intramuscular vaccinations, surgery, major trauma, but also to avoid overstretching your muscles because they all induce flare-ups and can lead to more heterotopic bone formation. Also important is to maintain lung capacity. If more bone forms around the thorax, it's important to keep this capacity as large as possible by exercising.
As we consider preventative measures for children with FOP, Dr. Eekhoff mentioned, you know, limiting activities that could cause injury. We oftentimes see accommodations being made at school. Maybe children participate in some way in a physical education class. Maybe they're the sports photographer than actually participating in sports in school. Or maybe they leave class early so that they're not bumping into other children in the hall when the halls are crowded. Fall prevention for people with FOP, whether you're a toddler or a teenager or even adult, is critical. One of the first things that patients lose the ability to move is their shoulders and their elbows. Those become locked. And so you lose the ability to break a fall. And head injuries can be a very serious, even life-threatening risk. So fall prevention is really important. Maintaining oral health is really important for people with FOP because the jaws of people living with FOP often lock. You think about the muscle in your face and head. As that calcifies, then you may lose the ability to open the jaw. So making sure that you have proper dental hygiene from the time children are infants all the way through the course of their life is very important. We don't want the teeth to get infected or inflamed. That can exacerbate the disease. We also know that as the jaw locks, the risk of aspiration is also great. So anytime that dental work is done or oral surgery is considered, an FOP expert must be consulted, and that information is available on the website of the International Clinical Council on FOP or on the website of the International FOP Association.
And how can FOP be treated effectively? And do we know enough about this rare disease to have confidence in these treatments?
No drug can completely prevent FOP. It's really a difficult disease. But there is one medication, palovarotene, a retinoic acid receptor gamma agonist, that inhibits gonadogenesis. And this is improved in some countries, not in Europe, but should not be given to young children due to side effects. Notably, impaired gonadogenesis at growth plays, as well as heterotopic endocrinal ossification. Since childhood is a time of rapid and extensive ectopic bone formation in most people with FOP, it's so important that medicine can effectively be used to inhibit heterotopic ossification in children as well as in adults. And maybe Michelle can tell more about it, but fortunately, several additional clinical trials are in progress. These can be viewed on the IVOPA website. They include the, for instance, in Europe, the Falcon, the Optima, the Progress, and the StopFOP study.
Yes, on the IFOPA's website, which can be found at ifopa.org, and then scroll down a bit on the page, you'll see quick links, and there is a link there to clinical studies and trials. In this section of the IFOPA's website, you'll find a clinical trials locator map. So you can input where the patient is located and find out what clinical trials are available and if they are actively recruiting or not. From those links, then you can go to clinicaltrials.gov to learn more about the inclusion-exclusion criteria. There's lots of other resources in this section that you can share with your patients to help guide them in their decision-making about clinical trial participation.
And I'll just add about having confidence in these treatments. I think, you know, the clinical trials that are being done, I think we can have a lot of confidence in the data and what we are learning. But we don't completely understand all of the biology behind all of these treatments. Some we know more about others. A wave of new treatments that will be tested are small molecule inhibitors for directly targeting the mutant ACVR1 protein. And as we're learning more about the biology or the functions of this protein, we're understanding more and more about what that protein does in many different cells, many different tissues of the body. So definitely more to learn.
It's an intriguing disease because it has three phases: inflammation, hopefully hypoxia, so gonadogenesis, and then osteogenesis, so three phases. And also the major cell origin is not totally known. We think FAPS, fibroadipogenic progenitors, but we're still searching for that.
I love that we're trying to learn more because it's a good segue to my next question. What further research do we still need to better understand and treat FOP?
So as a basic researcher, translational researcher, what I find is the more we learn, the more we know that we need to understand more and we need to learn more. So with FOP, treatments for FOP, the focus for very good reason is focused on the heterotopic ossification and the bone formation. But in addition to this extra bone, as has been noted, there's significant impacts on the normal skeleton and the joints. This is reflected in the toe malformations, but not limited to that part of the skeleton. Recent data show that muscle tissues and stem cells within muscle tissues are altered directly by the mutation and by interactions with mutant stem cells that are becoming the heterotopic bone. Immune cells, an immune component is certainly a critical early stage leading to the ectopic bone formation. And we've seen that the mutation directly affects immune cells. But all of this, we think, is just the tip of what we need to understand and what the impact is of the mutation in the body. And we need to know this to be able to provide the very best quality of life to people who have FOP and to avoid side effects from various treatments that may be used.
What kind of management and support will be important for someone with FOP?
Well, it is important that they have a multidisciplinary dedicated team in the hospital where they are being guided and followed. They need to be able to use medication for a flare-up. And normally it is an immune suppressive medication in conclusion or in consulting their doctor. In case of a trauma or dental procedures, they need to make contact with the site. In case of dental procedures, you really need to know where to give anesthesia, otherwise the jaw will lock. So that's very important. I also think it's important to look at the wheelchair without pressure points to prevent pressure wounds and appropriate aids. And IFOPA is helping a lot in that, Michelle.
One of the things that is really important to us is being able to support patients and families from their initial diagnosis and begin teaching them. They're facing a life of progressive disability, even with treatment options. There are patients and families that are going to face living with a disability. So we do provide lots of things. We have an occupational therapist on staff who then works with our families to identify tools and home adaptations that can help them live more independently. And you can find those resources at guidebook.ifopa.org.
Are there other resources available to help healthcare providers and patients and families treat and manage FOP?
Yes, there is FOP guidelines, which you can find on the ICC FOP website, but of course on the IFOPA website as well. Many information is written in this guideline.
I'd just like to add that in our research lab, we hope that we are a resource. We try to support clinicians and families any ways that we can, obviously by trying to understand the causes of specific clinical signs and symptoms, aiding diagnosis, but also I think by providing hope for the future that there's more to learn and more ways to approach treating the disease and hope for eventual cure.
So the IFOPA operates the FOP registry, which is the only registry that gathers information in one place about patients living around the world. And so it teaches us a lot of things about the comorbidities that people live with. And one of the things that we know is that for a third of patients, they experience hearing loss. So as you're caring for a patient with FOP, we've talked a lot about having a team of people, a multidisciplinary team. And so one of the things that we believe is important is to make sure, especially when children are young, that they are also referred to audiology. We've talked about preventative oral health care and dentistry as well. But I think one of the last things that I'll mention that's just really important is the mental health support that is really needed for patients and caregivers. It is critical. We learn more about it every day. They face a life of progressive disability. Our patients live with a tremendous amount of pain. So making sure that their mental health is supported, not just of the patients, but also for their caregivers, is a key component to making sure that we're truly caring for the patients. And through the IFOPA, our patient support group, we have a lot of online support groups that we do offer. And those are resources that you can find on our website or advertised on any of our social media channels as well.
A few times you mentioned the IFOPA website. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So the IFOPA website is designed to support patients and families, but it is also a resource for healthcare providers and researchers as well. We have lots of information about disease management and care, and you can find that under the patients and families section of the website. Lots of great resources for people at all stages of the disease. Under ifopa.org/emergency, you will find the FOP treatment guidelines that have been created by the International Clinical Council on FOP. You will also find contact information for a few of the FOP experts, clinicians treating patients in the U.S., as well as an FOP expert anesthesiologist, dentists, and also an oral surgeon. So it's a really important place to find information. I think the other thing, and it's linked to from our site, is the International Clinical Council on FOP. We've mentioned them several times. They are an autonomous group of physicians that have dedicated their careers to caring for people with FOP. Many of them are endocrinologists, rheumatologists as well. And that website you can find at iccfop.org.
So that's about all the time we have for this episode. We covered a lot of ground, and I just want to give my full appreciation to our three guests today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and telling us about FOP.
Thanks. It was great to be here. I hope everybody learned something new and follow up with me, or I think any of us, if you have questions.
And that's about all the time we have for today's episode. Hopefully, if you wanted those credits, you're listening to this on the Society's Center for Learning. If not, be sure to head over there using the link in today's episode description to take the corresponding tests and get those credits. If you want to learn more about FOP, the Endocrine Society will soon be launching a follow-up on-demand case report reading activity on the subject, and you'll be able to find that on the Society's Center for Learning. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll be back soon with another fantastic dive into the world of endocrinology. Until then, thanks for listening.
Endocrine News Podcasts are a free service of the Endocrine Society. To learn more or to become a member, visit the Society's website at www.endocrine.org.